1998 Salt Lake Suns Film Symposium presents Session 301, Joseph of Egypt's Failed Attempt to Forget, a reading by Kathleen Flake. This is a 30-minute devotional, so the majority of the tape will be blank.
Matter to you. Okay, I'll just use this one. Is this okay? Can everybody hear? I'm surprised because Kathleen Flake is very reliable. I think she might have overslept. And if she walks in while we're talking, I will just shut up and sit down. Good morning. On the final day of Sunstone, hope you've all had a good symposium. And this, again, is not prepared. This is just right off the top, but it's something that I was thinking about the story of Moses in the wilderness in Numbers chapter 17. Some of you know the story. The little snakes came walking out. God had sent snakes, you remember the story, to bite the Israelites and kill them off. You all know the story. And then God said to Moses, build a serpent and put it on a snake. This was discussed the other day in one of the sessions. I wasn't in that session. It may be repetitive. I hope not. I was doing some study one morning, trying to determine whether the word in the Hebrew for serpent was the same word as used in Genesis, where it talks about the serpent on the stick, where it talks about the serpent in the garden. And I was very surprised to see that in the chapter in Numbers, the word serpent is not in the Hebrew. It's not there. And if you look in your King James Version, you will see that it is in italics. Very, very surprising. I went back to the Hebrew text and found out that God did not ask Moses to build a serpent. He asked Moses to build a seraph. You know the cherubim and the seraphim. Moses then went back and built a serpent, and I thought to myself, why did he do that? God had clearly commanded him to do something, and he did something entirely different. I pondered it for a little while and figured out why this happened. Number one, it may be that Moses looked up in the sky and said, what the heck is a seraph? I've never seen one. Bill Cosby, yes. Sort of like the Noah's Ark routine. What are you talking about? Well, we have no record of Moses doing that. And besides, you know, back in Exodus, you told me not to build these things, these little images of things in heaven and in earth, and now you're telling me to build something of an image of something that's in heaven, and I've never been in heaven, so I don't have a clue what this looks like. So he had to decide to do something else. And the reason he built a snake, back then it was thought that when something was attacking you, whether it be a deity or whatever else, you built an image that looked like it, and then you bowed down to it, and then they stopped attacking you. They were pacified. It was the idea of God needing to be pacified that Moses was thinking of. We have an example of this later on, by the way. When the Philistines, attacked Israel and stole the Ark of the Covenant, the Bible tells us that they ran off with this box, very, very happy. And God, being angry with them for stealing the Ark of the Covenant, smote them with emeralds. And I didn't know what an emerald was, any more than Moses knew what a seraph was. So I looked it up, and an emerald is a hemorrhoid. God smote the Philistines with hemorrhoids. At which point they decided that God was a real pain in the butt. And what they did, according to the Bible, was they made little golden hemorrhoids. How they knew how to do this, I don't know, but they brought it back. They brought it with the ark, and they said, this is just too much. You take this ark back. Here's your golden hemorrhoids. We bow down to you. We worship you, O God of the hemorrhoids, and please take them away. And he did. Well, Moses knew he didn't know about that incident, but he knew about the practice. And the best he could do, the very best he could do, was to look at what was attacking him and make an image to it and have the people bow down to it. The surprising part of this story is that those who were bitten by the snakes didn't die, which meant to me that, and this was so thrilling to me because of how fallible we all are, God was not upset that Moses did not understand. God was not concerned one bit that Moses didn't do what he said, what he told him to do. He was only concerned that Moses did his best. He did what he thought was right. There's a sense in which Israel was a nation of Velcro. I gave a talk on this once a couple of years ago. You know how Velcro is. If you stick it up against something, it grabs little pieces of it. As Israel moved through the wilderness, you know, they just kind of picked up stuff as they went along. A little like Mormonism, you know, it is also a religion of Velcro. You know what I'm talking about. All religions are that way. And they picked up this idea from somebody. It wasn't from God. God never said, build a statue of a snake if you're going to be healed from the biting of the snakes. This is one of the things that Israel picked up. And the more I realized this, and the more I looked at Israel's practices, Lou, I know you've studied into this a lot, the more I understood that God was really open to so many things, so many experiences, so many practices, so many ways of doing things, far more liberal than any of his spokespeople in any religion have ever been. The fact that these people did not die of the snake bites, and whether we take it as a literal story or not, it makes no difference, the lesson is there. The fact that these people didn't die meant that God knew that Moses had picked up this practice, and he said to Moses, and again the thrilling thing to me, he says, you did your best, I'm going to honor it. I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do. And then we'll move on, and hopefully tomorrow you'll understand a little better what it is I want. But at each step, I have this feeling that those who superintend our spiritual lives in whatever church we belong to have far higher expectations of us than God ever did. And if we really want to have a measure of our spiritual progress and where we are on the spiritual path, I think we cannot look to the expectations of others, which is exactly what we do on an ongoing basis. But we have to look at how God treated those people in Scripture that we read about. And we're very surprised to learn that God was so tolerant and so open and so loving. As we go through our lives, and I've gone through probably about half of my life, I think, I look back at the times that troubled me most. And the times that troubled me most were not the times that I did poorly, but it's the times when I was disappointed in myself based on the expectations of others. And I've decided after learning about this serpent in the wilderness that I wasn't going to do that anymore. Now, does anybody know what happened to that pole, finally? Lou knows. What happened to it?
Holy relic, and finally, King Josiah had the thing broken.
That's correct. During Josiah's reforms, he walked into it was it kept in the temple? I forget. Yeah, and they found this image, and the people were still bowing down to it. Now, I think it had been many hundreds of years since those snakes had been attacking them, but they were still bowing down to it and using it as an object of worship. Now, that taught me the second and final lesson for this morning. As we come to recognize that our best efforts and our best deeds are honored by God and accepted by God, it is so easy to turn around and begin worshiping the efforts rather than worshiping the God who accepted those efforts. We look at things, the books that we've written, talks that we've given, gospel doctrine classes that we've taught, or used to teach, because we're no longer acceptable as gospel doctrine teachers. And when you realize that, when you come to understand that these things can become an item of worship, we become humbled, and we find a place where we can put these acts and these deeds in their proper place. We had a hand in the back there. Oh, all right. Well, hello.
Jeffrey,
hello there. Hi. Hi. Well, I'm done, and she's going to begin. Isn't that nice? Thank you.
I apologize. Those of you who know me know I'm compulsive about time, so I don't know how this happened, except I blew it, and I won't take any more of your time apologizing, but go right to my point. Which is, I text for my sermon this morning from Genesis 41:51. It's a text that you probably have not noticed, and I did not notice until this year. Genesis 41:51. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God, said he, hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. For God, said he, has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. Now the next thing that happens in the story, does anyone recall? His father's house ends on his doorstep. This is when his brothers appear. Now, I don't, of course, hold myself out to give you the meaning of the story of Joseph. I'm one of those that believes there's a multiplicity of meaning in the scriptures. I want to talk about a meaning today, a particular meaning, using this scripture as a pivot. Why Joseph would name his firstborn after his forgetfulness. I think that's the measure of what he was trying to forget and what he eventually failed to be able to forget. So, first question I would ask is, what was Joseph's toil that he was trying to forget? If I had the other 15 minutes for this morning, I would draw you out on that. And I can't thank this brother enough for substituting for me. Thank you, Jeffrey. But let me just tell you, by way of reminding you of what you know about this story and maybe drawing out for you from beneath the bare facts of the tale, some of the emotional content of this. Joseph's toil was a life, I believe, of betrayal, slavery, violence, after a very sheltered beginning that began with dreams of superiority and promise. So think back on the story. When you meet him, he's a young man. We say a coat of many colors, but as many of you know, that has been variously translated to a coat with long sleeves. Now, we all know what long sleeves signify because we use that expression today, roll up your sleeves and get to work. Joseph was not one of the workers in his family. And we are told that his brothers did not speak to him peacefully. We can imagine what that means out of our own families. He has these dreams of rulership, which he is so naive as to tell his brothers and his father. He is a special child who grows up in a place of privilege, who then goes out to meet his brothers in the field, and they do violence to him. We would say beat him up, at least, throw him in a pit, and leave him to wonder about whether he's going to live or not. So let your imagination, when you have more time, play upon the facts of that night. Reuben struggled to try to save him from death. Judah comes upon the solution of selling him to the Ishmaelites. And so he who had been a ruler in his own family now becomes a slave. This continues in his life through the story of being every time he rises to the top, he is betrayed. Not only in Potiphar's house, but when he is imprisoned. You recall that he obtains a promise from the butcher and the baker that they will tell Pharaoh the source of their wisdom, and they do not. Or the baker does not, I should say. The butcher doesn't survive long enough to speak. So what kind of man is Manasseh's father after all these experiences? What kind of man is this who names his son after his attempt to forget? Well, we know that he's inspired, and it's usually that part of the story that we focus on, that he is an inspired man of God. We add that last part, although God plays a very small part in Joseph's life in this part of it. Indeed, it's only in the Joseph Smith translation that we see the prophet. At 30, we are told, he is placed over all of Pharaoh's house and all the land of Egypt. It's an extraordinary responsibility, an extraordinary access to power. He wears the Pharaoh's signet ring, which was, of course, his signature. Right? That's what his signet ring is. It's his signature. He can't authorize anything in the name of Pharaoh. He rides in the second chariot, we're told, and that people bow down to him. He is called a ruler over Egypt. Not an assistant. This man is not an assistant to the president. He's a ruler. And he's a particular kind of ruler. If we look at chapter 47, there's a tale that interrupts the story. And, of course, those who engage in particular kinds of literary or textual criticism emphasize that this is probably another source that's added. But nonetheless, I'm dealing with this tale as a totality. What does the eventual redactor want us to know about Joseph by keeping this part of the story? But he is an unempathetic, even a victimizing ruler. It's not a part of the story that we tell, but we are told that Joseph, once he rules over Pharaoh's wealth, remember the seven fat years. We are now into the seven lean years, which begin immediately after Ephraim's birth, in the tale anyway. We don't know the chronology, but shortly thereafter, the Egyptians come to him, and at first they buy the food from Joseph. This is not the welfare program. They don't come to Joseph and get a slip of paper, then go to the bishop's storehouse and get food. They buy this food from Joseph, and once they are out of money, they come with their cattle and their land, and they trade away their means of income for food. And Joseph takes that. And once they have traded away all their means of making a living, then they sell themselves to Joseph, and they become slaves for food. And that's the Joseph we meet. That's one side of the Joseph we meet, of how he treats the Egyptians. We also meet Joseph as he treats his brothers. So just when he thinks he's forgotten his toil, as I said, his brothers land on his doorstep and you have a family reunion. Now, how does Joseph receive this family, whom he hasn't seen for at least 20 years? He speaks to them roughly, we're told. He acts a stranger. He accuses them falsely of dangerous intention, of being spies. Can you imagine being in Egypt, a foreigner, and you're greeted with this accusation of being a spy? He imprisons them all for 3 days, leaves them to wonder about their fate, and they are bound in prison. He takes a hostage in Simeon and demands Benjamin's life as ransom, the most precious thing they have, which essentially amounts to the life of their father in ransom for Simeon, and he eavesdrops on their confessions and their anxiety and their fears. And he tricks them. So after he abuses them physically and emotionally, in our terms, those euphemisms that hide so much terrible behavior, he then tricks them with money. He puts their money back in the bag. Now, he hears Reuben's reference to a sin against the child during his eavesdropping, and he weeps. But nevertheless, notwithstanding his weeping, which he hides from his brothers, he still binds Simeon before their eyes. He makes them watch as he ties Simeon up, and then he tricks and terrorizes them with the money and sends them on their way. They, of course, are not anxious to come back. It's only when the food is gone and their father says, "Why do you stand around? Why we're all hungry?" And then they explain to him the price of going back. So they take Benjamin with them and they go back into Egypt. And he greets them with, first of all, they come with double the money, of course. And he greets them with that phrase, "I had your money," and he brings out Simeon. And that, of course, is fraught with the tale of what was of value. "I have what is of value to you," and we remember the sale of Joseph to the Ishmaelites, and he brings Simeon out, and he asks them about his father. He'd asked them in the first visit, "Is his father still alive?" And it made me think about how Joseph must have felt about his father, who had favored him so much in his youth. Joseph was sold into slavery at about 16. And it made me wonder how much Joseph would have looked for his father to come rescue him, and he never came. Have you ever been in a place where you waited for rescue and it never came? Have you ever been there through your youth and as you achieve majority for 16 years, wondering why your father never came to find you? And so we don't know what Joseph thought about his father at this point, but it appears he didn't believe his father missed him. So he sees Benjamin, and at the sight of Benjamin, his baby brother, He flees into his chamber and he weeps. And this juxtaposition of Joseph's alternately terrorizing and increasingly breaking down and weeping over the revelation of his past is one of the most moving parts in all of Scripture, I think. But I have about 5 minutes left, so let me hurry through this. Yes? Is anyone using this room?
Not until quarter of.
So 10 minutes, and then like a ticket agent, Albert will tell you where your next session is. So he weeps, and he returns to eat with them, which shocks all the other Egyptians, because the Egyptians do not eat with the Hebrews. But nevertheless, notwithstanding his increase in empathy for their situation and consequently his own, the recovery of his own feelings about his toil, he still sets them up and chases them down. He accuses them, you know this story, how he sends them on their way, returning both amounts of money and hiding in Benjamin's sack his personal cup. So he sends his steward after them, and what do you think this steward looks like? An accountant? Probably not. And do you think the steward went alone? No, I'm sure he didn't. So he sends his men after them across the desert, apprehends them, and the story varies here. In one account, it appears Joseph then follows and confronts them there, but nevertheless, there is a confrontation, at which point he accuses them of returning evil for good and speaks in such a way that he lets them know that this time he's taking it personally. What do you think? I was a fool, I was stupid, that I wouldn't miss my cup. And they make an oath in protesting that they are innocent. They say, we offer you the life of him on whom the cup is found. Now Joseph knows where that cup is, right? And does he say, oh no, don't do that? He says, all right, I'll take your wager. I will take the life of him who has the cup. And of course, Benjamin has it. Now, this is not a forgiving man that we're reading about. This is a man who has achieved great power, whose life appears to have been involved in the obtaining of great power. We might say in our modern psychological terms, to compensate for his sense of powerlessness. It's also a man who spent a great deal of his life denying and insensitive to his need for power and denying his own violence. So that character of Joseph sets us up for the unraveling of the story by the appearance of his father and the confessions of his brothers. And this is in chapter 44 and 45. This is the first time in the Bible where the word forgiveness is used. It first begins with Joseph's realization of his father's bereavement over Joseph's death, what he thought was his death. And this is the first time Joseph learns that that's what his father thought. And he hears the phrase that his father's life is bound up in the lad's life. And Joseph begins to melt. In chapter 45, it says, well, the end of 44, Judah, the one who had sold him into slavery, says, how shall I go up to my father? And he has offered Joseph his own. Judah has offered his own life to Joseph in return for Benjamin's. For how shall I go up to my father, and the lad be not with me, lest peradventure I see the evil that shall come upon my father, meaning his father will die. Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him. And he cried, cause every man to go out from me. And there stood no man with him while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. One of those understatements. And Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. The first acknowledgement of what has happened to him. And he confronts them with the knowledge of who he is. And he is the person they sold into Egypt. He identifies himself in that action. Now, therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither. For God hath sent me before you to preserve life. Now, we are wont to read that verse and say, God meant this evil for good, so it's okay that you did this evil. And I think that's a misconstruction of what's going on here. The fact that God sent me before you doesn't mean that God caused you to sell me into slavery, that I may be sent before you. It's not unlike a similar interpretation we make at the tree, where we assume that God meant for Eve to eat the apple. But he simply couldn't be quite straightforward with them about it. He hid his purposes from them, that he must act manipulatively with us to obtain his will. I would suggest to you, brothers and sisters, that the nature of God's omnipotence lies in his control after the fact, not before the fact, in his ability to make doo-doo into shinola. Okay? That's the God I understand. So, for instance, in the garden story, it is possible to understand the phrase that, nevertheless, I command you not to eat now. We don't know what God would have done later in the garden. We don't know what his intentions were because the story doesn't allow us to know. The story doesn't go that way. That's not what happens. So God's actions are in response to what happens. Here also, I would understand, not that Joseph is saying, forget it, what you did was right because it came out all right. We confuse those two things. The brothers do not, though. You know the story. They go back and say that Joseph is alive. And it's very touching what his father says. In verse 28 of that same chapter, he says, And Israel said, It is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. So this old man hauls himself across the desert to see this son who makes his life worth living. And you have the reunion between them where they greet each other so lovingly. And life goes on until Israel dies. And when Israel dies, the brothers have their concern again that their brother will come out against them. Now that tells you that there hasn't been a reconciliation yet, because the brothers say, Father is dead, and now Joseph will kill us. The only reason he kept us alive was for our father's sake. So the brothers have always recognized the love between this father and son. And now that the father is gone, there's nothing standing between them and justice. And so they are so afraid at this point that they send a messenger to Joseph, who is still a very powerful man. And they ask Joseph a favor. They say, if you will let us live, we will be your servants. So Joseph at last has what everyone seeks when they use that phrase, poetic justice. They will be his servants. As he was sold into service to the Ishmaelites, they are offering to sell themselves for their life into the hands of Joseph as servants. And Joseph's response is in verses 17 through 19. The brothers come and fall down before his face, and they said, Behold, we will be thy servants. And Joseph said unto them, Fear not, for am I in the place of God? Now that's one of those phrases that we tend to read quickly through, and I think we need to look at that. In that phrase, he gives up his claim against his brothers and says, Justice is not mine. I leave it in the hands of God. But neither does he say, I forgive you as if I am God, because that is God's business to do. They have work to do with God, not with him. Now, if you think of Joseph earlier, he certainly was acting the role of God. and he felt himself to have that kind of omniscient power, I suppose, that anyone would naturally feel if they wore the signet of Pharaoh. But here he says, "Fear not, for I am in the place of God. But as for you, you thought evil against me." Lest we misunderstand what's going on here, he does not forget. He remembers that they have done evil to him. I suggest to you that to forget what they have done to him is also to forget who he is. That Joseph cannot forget this event unless he pays the price of forgetting who he is. So he says, "I am not God. You have worked with God. But I know you did evil against me." And then there's this phrase, "But God meant it unto good to bring to pass as it is this day to save much people alive." I disagree with the redactor in that twist, and I would look to other translations and earlier texts to see what this phrase is. But now therefore fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spake kindly unto them. So he succored them, he cared for them, but he did not forget. Neither did he act like God in seeking to do violence to them or to try to obtain from them a just recompense for what had happened to him. Because ultimately, I believe, for the evil that is done to us, there is no justice in human terms. And that to hold on to the anger and the vengeance is to hold on to the hope that things can be put back the way they are. And to hold on to that hope, in part, perverts our definition of God, that he is someone who can do that, and therefore he should have not allowed this to happen in the first place. It is intimately tied up with our notions of the nature of God and the nature of evil. I think this story, probably more than any New Testament story, notwithstanding the New Testament's emphasis on forgiveness, more than any New Testament story, illustrates the nature of forgiveness in our lives and what the response to evil must be, which is not to forget, but to receive that grace from the Lord that allows the reformation, the reformation, if you will, of our souls, that we may triumph over the evil that has been done to us. But as the book of Ether says about weaknesses becoming strengths, if we humble ourselves, humility is required. We cannot take the role of God and seek wholeness through vengeance. And that was the lesson Joseph learned. And that's what eventually makes him a what we would call a patriarch or a father. And so the text is careful to tell us that he nurtures them and he comforts them. And it's out of that humility that he obtains the power to care for his family and to achieve the fullness of his identity that we then see in chapter 50 in the Joseph Smith translation as he prophesies about his family. But first, the path came through memory and humility and even his own kind of repentance and reconciliation with his own fate. That's how I understand the working out of evil and forgiveness, at least in this Old Testament story that I think illustrates the best of what is said in the New Testament. So thank you. And I again ask your forgiveness for being late. Albert, you? Okay, go to the next sessions.